Light is all around us. From the morning's first rays of sun to the waning glow of a crescent moon, light is our guide. Light shows us where to go and how to react. And there's nowhere where this is more apparent than when you're at a concert, listening to your favorite band, and the lighting designer is firing on all cylinders.
I'm your host, Luke Stratton. Join me each episode as I sit down with different lighting designers, directors, and programmers from the live music industry. We'll dig deep to find out what makes them tick, what tools they use to get the job done, and what it means to be a mad scientist, a wizard, and sometimes even a Jedi. You're listening to The Light Side. All right, here we are, episode 2. I'm with Greg Ellis, the laser shark of Pretty Lights. Greg, how's it going?
Good. How's it going out there in internet land?
What's going on, Greg? All right, Greg. Well, let's start at the beginning. I want to start with the breakfast, or maybe even before that, since I don't know your full background. How did you get into the entertainment industry, if you will?
Well, the very first situation for me as a lighting designer was working for my best friend of the last 15 or 16 years, Phil Salvaggio's college band called Resi.
What college is this?
SUNY Oneonta.
I know Oneonta.
Yeah. It's the name came from the reservoir of Oneonta, which we used to hang out at and do dumb things. Anyway, I dropped out of school, and even before college, I was touring around with them, you know, as an excuse to get into bars and drink as a underage person and having fun. And one day, Phil basically was like, listen, you come to all the shows, you know the music, why don't you do something? And, you know, it seemed like a pretty good idea. So, I don't know, there's some bar somewhere that had a little, you know, 8-channel board or something.
DMX faders, and that's it.
Yeah, you know, just parkhands and whatever. And quickly found out that I had very natural, good talent, timing, could keep in time with the music, you know, even the odd-timed things and what have you. And it just kind of seemed to work.
Around 2004, 2005, you got started with the Psychedelic Breakfast. How did that come into play?
We used to book this venue in Oneonta called The Pub. And
was it General Clinton's Pub?
You know it.
Yeah.
And so we brought Psychedelic Breakfast down there a few times. And at that point, we had bought a small little lighting package of American DJ Scan 250s. We also had some LightQuest Motorheads for all you real big dorks out there who know what those are. You know, just a little whatever DMX controller of some sort. I don't even remember what it was. And so when we booked the breakfast, that was our favorite band. So we would travel all around the Northeast to go see them. And when we finally brought them to the pub, basically it was like, hey, I'm going to come do lights. And they were all like, cool.
Yeah.
Do lights, sure, whatever you want, you know? Like, even at that point for them, like, they didn't have any crew, really.
Yeah.
They had a sound guy, but that was it. So, afterwards, they were all stoked on it and, you know, just continued to go see them as a fan and, you know, got to know the guys a little bit. And one day, the conversation came up, and it was like, you want to move to New Haven, Connecticut and come do lights for us full time?
The pizza is amazing.
With the caveat that we can't really pay you. So, you know, if you want to do this, you want to get out of Oneonta, like Tim Palmieri, the guitar player, he was moving into a new place and he was like, listen, come live with me and we'll just kind of figure it out. And so I threw all my shit in a car one day and moved to New Haven and started working for them.
Awesome.
And 4 years of my life, Went by with them, making $20 a show. It was amazing.
You never got a raise?
Nope.
Oh, my God.
Nobody got a raise. Are you kidding me? I think we made less money as the years went on, so, yeah. You know.
I mean, even though they, like, won a jammy and were in Relics and all that stuff.
It was a very unfortunate path that they had to, that we had to travel. Try as we might, and, you know, we never never took any shortcuts, you know. It was... There's a great line in a song, and it's that goes, "Learning the hard way," and it repeats over and over many times. And that was pretty much the mantra of life on the road with the Breakfast.
Well, so, how about gear with them? Did you have a console?
At the best it ever was, I had a Martin Exciter, which I don't know if anyone knows that console.
Not me.
So
there's
an amazing picture of me on Facebook running that desk. I can't even call it a desk, but running that console on stage, I strapped it up with a guitar strap, and we called it the Lightboard Guitar.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
I ran lights on stage at a New Year's Eve show at the Electric Company in Utica, New York,
awesome.
The greatest venue in the history of rock and roll. But we had that, and then there were some techno beams, the Martin, there was, I don't even remember what they were called, but they're tiny little scanner, like little 250 scanners.
Yeah,
no, it's all the same shit. So, but yeah, techno beams, American DJ, Martin, all.
There's something to be said for cutting your teeth on that, like, terrible gear, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, I feel like if you can't put on a show in a small bar on terrible gear, you're never going to be able to do it on real gear, you know?
Absolutely. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people, and I think learning on that stuff really teaches you the nuances of what it takes to create a compelling light show. And it also challenges you to get creative with very minimal programming techniques, you know? Like, I mean, on my Exciter, there was three wave forms, and you call up a channel and you tell it how big and how small, and that was pretty much it.
It kind of reminds me of, like, imagine you're trying to compose for an orchestra. I know this is a little grandiose, but, like, how could you expect to write an amazing symphony when you can't even write a melody on a violin, you know?
Absolutely.
It's like you have to know those basics.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how did you transition from working for The Breakfast to working for Pretty Lights?
It all goes back to Phil Salvaggio. I moved to Connecticut, and Phil didn't feel like he should stay in Oneonta anymore either. So he hopped in his car and moved to Colorado. And he discovered Pretty Lights through, you know, musical connections that he had made out there, and started working for him. So he started running sound for Pretty Lights, and he called me up one day and he's like, "Listen, I think you need to get your ass out to Colorado because this thing's about to blow up." And this would have been in 2008. So nobody really, you know, there was a buzz. I had never heard of him. I didn't know much about electronic music in general other than the Disco Biscuits and Soundtribe. So that whole, like, bubble that was kind of blossoming out in Colorado, I was completely unaware of. And once again, on a whim, I threw all my shit in a van and moved to Colorado with no job guaranteed or anything. In fact, by the time I made it out there, somebody else had already gotten the job because he bought a bunch of gear, showed up one day, and he was like, "Hey, I got all this cool gear. I'm going to do lights." And they were like, "Cool, sure." And so I had to, like, kind of wait my turn, so to speak. I got called in to do my first show running lights for Pretty Lights was 10,000 Lakes Music Festival up in Minnesota, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's where it was.
So that was my first show. That would have been the summer of 2009. And then shortly after that, I was actually brought on to run video, which was strange to me because as a rock and roll kind of traditionalist, I was not a huge fan of video at that time. But I took the opportunity, you know, because I saw the writing on the wall that the whole thing could be mine given, you know, the right circumstances. So, you know, I learned everything that I could about running video, about I was importing DVDs onto my computer and splicing them up to make content.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah, you know, and, you know, I just dove headfirst into that whole world. and, you know, took it, you know, in stride as far as, you know, watching somebody next to me do a very terrible job. But at the same time, just knowing that if I just stuck it out long enough, yeah,
you just got to be the right guy at the right time.
Yeah. And it only took one tour for it to work itself out.
So what was it like to be on board as Pretty Lights went from a small act to one of the largest EDM acts in the country?
We talk about this a lot, how lucky we were to get in on the ground floor and watch this whole thing.
When you say we, do you mean like you and the crew? Or
yeah, well, Phil and I. So Phil's been working for Derek since 2008. I've been working with him since 2009. And we've also happened to have been best friends since we were 16 years old. So, you know, there's this amazingly crazy relationship that we share and we have for half of our lives and gone through all these different things. And so we talk about these things about, you know, what it was like in the beginning versus what it's like, you know, even 3 years ago. And it's changed so drastically and in a weird way. And I think this is more a product of the times. We in a little less than 10 years, we've kind of established ourselves as the elder statesmen of this bubble. Now granted the bubble hasn't existed that long, so I guess that's why it makes it a little easier. You know, you would say that about a band like, you know, the Rolling Stones or U2 that have been doing it for 30, 40 years, but the range of rock and roll also exists exponentially longer. So for us, you know, I'm not comparing us to those bands by any stretch.
No, I think it's a good analogy. Yeah.
You know, but like, you know, so we've kind of aged both gracefully and ungracefully, but we are very cognizant of all of it, you know, and we observe and we take all of it in, and we've been affected mostly by the fact that I think that we were so young and so stupid, and we came out the other side old and smart.
Yeah.
And it's become an amazing place to exist because there's this incredible artistic freedom that we experience. You know, we do have some luxuries as far as, you know, obviously we sell a fair amount of tickets, so we get to spend a little bit more money than the average act. And so, you know, I'm blessed to have the opportunities that I have both creatively and also on the gear side, the access that I have to both gear and companies. And I mean, my relationship with a brand like Roby, for instance, like it's I don't even really have words for it, because that's how, like, you know, incredible it feels to be able to do these things.
Yeah, I have to say, being in a project that's a more band oriented, you know, when you think about a band that's a four or five or six piece and you're cutting that pie, there's no room for equipment at the low level, you know. And
absolutely.
And when you start with a act like Pretty Lights, pretty quickly it's, oh, I can get a PA on tour with me, because there's no guys to pay. So I can see how the lighting budget is there a lot sooner, and then that's kind of like a feedback loop.
You know? Absolutely.
The show's better, more people come to see it, you know.
Yeah, and that is where the arms race kind of began, was that whole notion.
Arms race, that's great.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we joke about it all the time. You know, there was us, Bass Nectar, Skrillex. We were like the big Skrillex came a little later, but like it was always like, who can one up who, you know,
yeah,
you know, five years ago. And you know, and then you have acts like Big G and Grizz and so many others that I'm not even aware of. But you know, when you have one, maybe two people on stage, you need to fill that stage somehow.
Yeah.
You know, so that's when you started seeing the giant video arrays and these massive lighting rigs and the lasers and all of and scenics and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's more money opportunities because there are less people involved on stage. So it's like, well, if I was going to pay a guitar player $10,000 to stand on stage, I can spend $10,000 on lights instead.
Yeah. I mean, especially given the style of music, too, it's very conducive to that.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the Pretty Lights name and how it's not necessarily what people may think it is.
So, yes, it's one of the biggest misconceptions, blah, blah, blah.
One I think that's worked in your favor.
Totally worked in my favor, but it's something that weighs on Derek from time to time, I feel, just because it meant so much more to him than this artificiality of the, look at my cool light show, you know? Sidebar, it's ironic that the last two acts that I work for are both references to Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
So for all of you out there, Psychedelic Breakfast is a reference to a Pink Floyd song called Alan's Psychedelic Breakfast off of the album Atom Heart Mother. It's amazing. Go listen to it. Two, Pretty Lights is a reference to a concert poster in which I believe it's Pink Floyd and maybe The Who on New Year's Eve. And there's a saying that says, come and watch the pretty lights. And Derek saw that, and his whole idea behind it and how it stems to the music is the notion of kind of taking it all in, observing the beautiful things around you, regardless of the situation, just really having a keen awareness to life and nature and urban nature and all of it. And it means so much more to him and to all of us than just this big raucous light show, you know, that happens at the concerts, you know, because it really stems to the music itself, not the show.
I like that a lot because it's a great name from a marketing perspective for what he's doing, but that's not what it means. So anybody who pays any attention at all is rewarded immediately by finding out that that's not the case.
Absolutely. It's one of those things, you know, especially looking back on it now and really having a much grander understanding of what it all means. He struck gold, first and foremost. He struck gold, but also he has this amazing ability to, like, draw the lines in his favor.
Sure.
You know, beyond just the name. The way he approaches the business aspect of things and the creative and just all of it, he just has a knack for doing the right things.
Yeah. I mean, and I will say, too, the music is great. Like, there's no denying that. I remember back in 08, 09 on Fantasy Tour, like, check this out. It's free. Like, oh, this is like a DJ that people who don't normally like EDM might like a lot. When you were getting going, who were some of your, like, biggest influences?
I mean, there are two names that will and for always be the guys that meant the most to me. And one is Chris Carota of Phish fame.
Who?
Exactly. The second will be Andy Watson of Radiohead fame and a bunch of other stuff, like Tori Amos and other weird shit that nobody actually goes to see.
You know, as shocking as this is, I've never actually seen Andy work before. So
that's unfortunate.
I feel like I'm missing out. People keep talking about him. So.
He is unbelievably brilliant, but also in the same sense that he started on the ground floor. You know, he's been with Radiohead since 93 or 94, which is practically the beginning.
I almost feel like there should be a new title of a visual producer. You know, it's like there are some guys in the industry, yourself one of them, that are so important to the act, at least from a live perspective.
The title that I've kind of been harboring as of late is production designer.
There you go.
It's all encompassing.
Sure.
Design the production, whether it be video, whether it be lights, whether it be lasers, whether it be scenic, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just at this, you know, because it isn't just lights anymore, you know. And also, as technology kind of allows us to embrace multiple worlds, we aren't, you know, there isn't, like, there is, but there isn't just the light guy and then the video guy and the laser guy.
No, you need a captain now.
Yeah. And but, you know, anybody who wants to really strive in this industry should be willing to accept all facets of the industry.
Let's talk about the analog future live band versus the current live band versus when he's just DJing. What's that like for you? How is it different?
Okay, well, let's start with the current product.
And that's the live band.
Yes, we're just Pretty Lights Live, I guess is how it's billed at festivals and what have you. It is what I've always hoped Pretty Lights would become. Derek will kill me for saying this, but we are approaching jam band territory. I think his term for extending a song is flipping it. But yes, it's a 5-piece band consisting of 2 keyboard players surrounded by more ridiculous gear than you could possibly imagine, a drummer, and a DJ dropping samples and live scratching, and then Derek with all of his analog madness surrounding him. And it's the most open and improvisational product that we've ever put out. It's also been the most fun, I think, for everyone involved. I haven't seen Derek have as much fun and be as happy as he has been in the last 6 months as far as these shows have gone. It's been absolutely amazing. And that's not to take away from anything that's happened in the past. I just think that we kind of found something in this project that has just really, really just like hit a spark. And it's just been so much fun. And for me, coming from the jam band world and then, you know, being associated with this whole EDM kind of side of things for the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, it's just been amazing to see the melding of those two worlds in what is happening right now. You know, the first band iteration, the Analog Future Band, was had a much more big band feel to it. We had a horn section. The instrumental songs were more orchestrated. Wasn't much straying from the norm. You know, there were some nights where things got a little crazy and got a little outside of the box, but you know, it was a much more straightforward approach, and less adventurous. It was much more just about fun, energy, you know, playing the songs really well and just bringing just high energy, you know, to each and every show. Where this show, it gets dark, it gets slow, it gets psychedelic, it gets everything.
I can imagine that's a lot more exciting to light, having those different palettes to play with.
It's different. I would never say that it's more or less exciting, because I think maybe the Analog Future Band, it felt bigger. So it maybe hit different peaks, or the songs maybe were more exciting, but you know, but now it's like you take these journeys and that, from, you know, it's more gratifying now because it's so much more challenging. My approach has never changed as far as how I light the show. Like, the same buttons are still in the same place, so to speak. I mean, granted, I've only been on the MA for 2 years now, but the ideas haven't changed. But how the ideas are ran is what's changed, I guess. I'm much more patient, I think, because I know now, like, I can't just bounce from idea to idea throughout a song. It's like, okay, I gotta let this sit.
Yeah, where is it gonna go?
Yeah, and try to anticipate more. So I'm thinking more in some ways, but I'm also thinking less because it's improv. Yeah. And so there's this crazy balancing act that's happening. It hasn't been easy to make the transition in the sense that certain decisions that were made in the in programming the show file, I think, have forced me to work harder during the show. Mm-hmm. There is not a single written look in the entire show file.
You meaning there's no one button that like just makes the
makes
whole
everything
rig.
Happen. Yeah. There actually is one. There is one for the chorus of Finally Moving, which is the sing-along section, and it's literally every light too white, wide open at the crowd, just light up the audience. Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. That's the only one. That is one. There is one. Everything is just fundamental. There's a lot of macro tricks and what have you, but it's all just fundamental preset punching kind of style. And what I learned from Andy Watson in his early days was it was a very swap-heavy show. And during my time with Psychedelic Breakfast, I also worked at Toad's Place in New Haven, Connecticut, which is one of the most legendary venues in the country. It has so much history.
We were just there a couple weeks ago.
So in my time, we had an Avo Pearl, which, you know, for anyone out there, the Avo Pearl is the swapping master of the world.
can you just explain what swapping is for those maybe?
Okay, so a swap is when you push a button, it will turn whatever button you have assigned or whatever fixtures you have assigned to it on, while at the same time turning everything else off, unless you swap protected.
Of course.
So that's where it gets tricky, because I have 8 million different things going on within the show file that may or may not be swap protected, and kind of knowing how to navigate through all of that. So much of what I do in the show is move in black. So I'm swapped on one part of the rig, and when I'm pushing a bunch of buttons, it's not to make whatever you see happen. It's to make the next thing and the next thing after that happen. And so in that sense, it's an amazing tool for improvising, because you can sit there and think about it for a while and be like, okay, well, while I'm holding down these three buttons, I can make the video do these five different things, and I can make the lasers do these five different things. And when I take my hand off these three buttons, it's a whole new world. And that is the bread and butter of what I bring to the table as far as a lighting designer, is just always being able to create a new environment without, you know, pre-planning any of it.
Can you walk us through the last couple light rigs, maybe starting with the City Towers rig?
Yeah.
Like, how many major revisions are there between there and where you are now?
I mean, I would say that there are three. Yeah, we can go with three.
Including the City Towers rig?
Yeah, so basically there are different iterations of the tower design that existed from 2011 through 2012. In 2013 was when I made the bold decision to, it was also the debut of the Analog Future Band, made the bold decision to cut video out of the show. And that kind of goes back to that whole conversation about the arms race. And it was another situation where it's like, okay, well, if everyone has a big video show, what do we do to separate ourselves? Let's just get rid of it, you know? And so, so there's that design, and then the current design, which is basically an amalgamation of everything that we've done over the last 5 years, plus a whole bunch of new things. But it's which I think also the music is, you could say the same for the music as well, is it kind of takes little bits and pieces of everything. But so in 2011 and 2012, we had the tower design, which was basically freestanding towers of video set to look like a cityscape. In those days, I would imagine we were using Mac 3s and 101s, maybe some Sharpies. I don't remember. Tons of 101s. I know in let's see, it would have been New Year's in Broomfield, Colorado. I think there's like 120 101s in that rig. That was a one-off special, but I love those lights. I wish
they're bright and fast.
Man. Yeah, you know, I wish. I know that there's some things coming out that could potentially bring me back to that idea. Hopefully, it happens. We'll see. In 2013, when we ditched video, that's when it was like, okay, I don't have video to fall back on. You know, video was a huge safety net for me. It allowed me to, you know, if I felt like I was doing too much, I could just fall back, let video do its thing. And it's something that I learned to really appreciate once it was gone, you know? And so it forced me, one, to become a better programmer, because I was like, well, shit, there's no video. It's just a bunch of lights and lasers. I'm going to have to do a much better job. But it also inspired me to really take lasers by the reins, in the sense of I would fly to Pittsburgh, where there's Washington, Pennsylvania, is where Lightwave International is based out of. I would fly to their compound. I would work with their programmer, Mike Dunn, who is a mad scientist genius, and I have nothing but amazing, loving words to say about him. And, you know, we would work on things together, and we developed this whole system, and it was so convoluted at the time, it was so convoluted looking back on it, but at the time, it was what worked the best for how I thought it needed to go, and it really changed not only how I ran lasers, but people's perception of the lasers. It was much more static. It was much more psychedelic. It wasn't all about the big, flashy, effect-driven laser show. It was much more crafted towards a lighting designer's aesthetic. Mm. And that's when the real change happened, because I had the freedom to do those things. I had the negative space to do more subtle tricks with the lasers. You know, when video was there, you had to just be big and bold for it to cut, and that was that. And I struck on something initially during those programming sessions, because we were limited with how we could control playback. So we literally wrote the same cue 20 times with different multicolor looks. So basically, we were making presets of the exact same, you know, laser effect, so that it could match lighting, and you know, and then we would do it 20 more times, and like it was ridiculous, but it was amazing.
And this is on CamSys. I mean, this is the console you're using.
Yes, I was using CamSys, and then at that time, I want to say we were using these little Pangolin DMX controlled playback packs that basically had a little SD card that held all your information on it.
Okay.
And then at some point, I felt like it wasn't enough anymore, and we made the jump to actually running Pangolin software, the Beyond software, and we had to write this whole crazy profile, and it was a huge undertaking, and it still is. I actually was just at Lightwave a couple of weeks ago working on the new version of Beyond, which is amazing once we got the bugs worked out. And it's... I'm going to debut a whole new laser show at our New Year shows, and it's going to blow people's minds. It's going to be outrageous.
So is it safe to say that you're developing most of your own patterns?
The actual playback clips are written by Mike for the most part. I've got a couple of pages of stuff that I've done, but really at the end of the day, they're very simple animations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what it comes down to, it's kind of the same thing, you know, as in lighting, right? Where it's like, okay, well, you're handed a light that can do 12 gobos, right? But we can all make them look very differently depending on what your approach is. Now, that's not to take away from what Mike does for me, because the guy is, like I said, he's unbelievable. And he's actually just made me, well, he didn't make them for me, but he handed me about 200 new clips that I can't wait to use in a couple of weeks.
Nice.
Of just really, really amazing new, like, out-of-the-box laser looks. But beyond just the clips themselves, you know, it's the same thing. It's how you operate it. It's also the combination of the clip running, you know, using quick effects on top of them to really distort, you know, what's happening. So it's a very intensive world as far as understanding how much is possible. Because so much is possible with lasers. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about the gear that you're using on tour right now. Can you maybe give us a rundown of all the fixture types that you have in the current rig?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I want to thank the amazing folks at Roby for giving me the opportunity to debut one of their new lighting fixtures on this tour, the Roby Spiky.
Oh, man, is it cool.
It is hands down the most fun light to use. It's an LED sourced wash beam hybrid-y kind of fixture. I wouldn't put it in the same category as like an Axiom or a Mythos or anything like that.
Yeah, no gobos.
No gobos. It has a flower effect built into it, which what it does is it diffracts the LED mixing. So basically, your end result, if you hit it on a wall or something, or if you see it on the stage, it creates this plaid effect. If you're in a multicolored look, or if you're in singular color, then it just diffracts the beam, and then you just have a nice splay.
Are you saying like if you're on orange, you'd see red and green?
Absolutely. Yeah. It also has continuous pan and tilt.
I don't want to glaze over that. That's an amazing feature. If you were a lighting designer 3 years ago, that would never exist.
Well,
you
it did. Just, Airtime had it.
Well,
years
let's
ago.
Say to the public,
yes.
The mass public.
Yes.
The fact that you can just spin the light in any direction continuously.
Yeah, well, the most amazing part about it is that Airtime isn't the only company that has it anymore.
Yes.
That's the amazing part. I have the Spiky. There's a 36 or 40 or something like that in the rig. And then I also have the Roby BMFL, which I've been using now for about 2 years, and I love that light to death. It's a big, robust spot fixture.
Bright, very bright.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't stand for what you think it would stand for, but it should stand for bright motherfucking light, because it really is.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have the Clay Packy BIs, the K20s. Which
amazing fixture
isn't yes another like I said I have I am so unbelievably lucky to have access to the things that I have access to because I do get to work with a lot of the best gear out there.
How many BIs do you have?
I think I have 18 in this rig.
Yeah.
You know, this year was I came to terms with something this year in the sense that I was going back and I was looking at videos and I was looking at pictures and whatnot, and I always felt like the stage felt really cluttered. And this year was the first year where I made a conscious effort to cut back my numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's only 14 spots, it's 18 BIs, and then the 36 Spikies, and that's my lighting package. I have some auras in there that I use for band wash 5 minutes out of the show
because
they like to play in mostly dark. But, I mean, that's it. You know, some strobes and stuff.
It's interesting, though, because I feel like if you compared that package to what maybe a normal touring band would take out, each system, like when you're swapping, each system is enough to fill the air.
Absolutely.
So that's the beautiful thing, is that you can have a great BI look and then swap to a laser look and then swap to a BMFL look. It's great.
Yep. And to that point, less fixtures of each type allowed me to combine so that I could just swap all lights to all video.
Yeah.
As opposed to mixing and matching certain like ideas or just like swap. So like, you know, when I had 120 101s, it was like, oh, I'll just swap to just the 101s. And it's awesome, but it's just a bunch of 101s. You know, now it's like, okay, well, I only have 60 lights in the rig total. Now it's like, okay, I have this really beautiful lighting effect. And then I could just hard swap into a nice big laser wash look, you know, and jump around like the three zones, as I call them. You know, it's you have your lasers, you have your video, and you have your lights, you know. And then obviously there's mixing and matching as well. And then, of course, you know, the BIs offer the interesting opportunity that 18 lights turn into whatever 18 times 37 is.
Yeah, a lot of pixels.
A lot. You know, and the shapes, you know, lens, bubble lens thing or whatever allows you to trick everyone into thinking that those 18 lights are 1,000 lights.
Mm-hmm. So are you video mapping onto the BIs, or is that just totally an MA?
I'm about to implement that on New Year's with the new update. I'm importing all of the low-res video that I run on the... So to go back, the slices are the little video bars on stage, the forest of video that the band plays inside of. And then we also use on all of the headers, on the header video, on all of the trusses, the flown trusses, that's the ROE hybrid product, which is a, 10 mil, 12 mil product, but then it also has those big LED cells.
Yeah.
However, I don't know what the dimensions are. 20 pixels? I don't know.
Yeah.
But basically how I run it is the slices and we call them spotlights. They're the big cells. Those run off a completely separate system from the rest of the video show. And it's all very, like, just honestly, it looks like shitty video content that some VJ, you know, in the bumfuck nowhere made, you know, 10 years ago. Like, a lot of it looks like garbage. But on that product, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of like an LED curtain look.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's so low profile and it's so low res that you don't need crazy 3D animations. You just let the texture do the work, and that's it. It's not meant to represent anything.
So you're going to move that over to the BI pixels.
Exactly. Awesome. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time on the bitmapper system from Camsys, and it's very similar to the new bitmapper system implemented by MA. And so I think I have a head start maybe as far as getting really, you know, comfortable with you know, incorporating that into the show file, and already have made huge strides in just opening up what's possible for the BIs, but also helping incorporate the BIs into the video world. And so now for this whole tour, it's been like BI looks, let's try to match it to what's happening with the low res video or complement it. Now they can all work in unison together, and it's just going to make that part of the show so much more impactful. But also, it's going to be some shit that I don't think anybody's seen before, like negative space, but also feel big at the same time. It's going to be wild, but we're also redesigning the video for the New Year's shows due to venue constraints. And so the plan is to engulf the band in a new way that nobody's seen yet. There's going to be a new balance in the rig as far... It's going to be very video heavy on the floor like it once was, but in a very different way. And so the play between the video and the BIs is going to be paramount to making that show really unique and different from what we've been doing over the last 6 months.
You're listening to The Light Side, Episode 2. My guest this episode is Greg Ellis, the laser shark of Pretty Lights. If you want to know more about Greg, he's got a brand new website, thelasershark.com. He's got a lot of cool rig rundown information on there, but there's also a lot of information for non-technically minded people as well. So if you're just a curious mind, or especially if you're a Pretty Lights fan, definitely check it out. If you're enjoying the podcast, check out my website, lukestrattondesigns.com. Also got a Facebook page, Luke Stratton Designs. My guest next episode is Paul Hoffman of Pulse Lighting. He's the LD for Widespread Panic. Numerous Grateful Dead projects, including Fare Thee Well, in conjunction with Candace Brightman. I also wanted to thank everybody for the enormous response we got from episode one. Really way more than I expected. A lot of non-lighting people really tuned in and gave their feedback, and I really appreciate that. I got a lot of questions about specific jargon that we used in episode one. If you guys want to hit me up on Twitter, Luke_Stratton, I'm happy to answer as many of those questions as I can. As you might have noticed, I try to keep the format here to be, you know, the first half is a little more accessible to people who maybe aren't in the industry, but I promise every episode we're getting nerdy. So without further ado, let's get back to my interview with Greg. Let's switch gears and talk about the lighting console. Give us a rundown on what the switch was like from Camsys to MA2. What do you miss? What do you love about MA2? How has that been? Who got you to switch? Did anybody show you the ropes?
You know, I've always been a guy that just kind of figures it out. And I'll start by saying this. And I don't want to give people the wrong impression because Camsys is an amazing company. And they do put out a really great product, but my frustrations with them just kept growing, and I felt like they didn't really meet my needs as I became more of a, you know, I was one of the biggest Camsys promoters in this country for a very long time, and, you know, there was something just... miscommunication, maybe, I don't know, but it just never really things just never really lined up properly. And then at some point, when they started developing their new stadium console and this whole new OS, I just found too many bugs, and it just wasn't a workable system for me anymore. So I basically one day we were taking an extended period of time off at the beginning of last year. And I was like, well, if there was ever an opportunity for me to just explore my options, this is it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got 4 months, 5 months off, whatever, 4 months I think it was, because the first show was Euphoria in Austin, Texas. It was my first show on the MA, and it was absolutely dreadful.
High stress.
So bad. Well, you know, the big thing that happened was there's something different in the numeric keypads between the two consoles. I couldn't tell you what the difference is. And I was really, really fast. I miss the buttons on the Camsys. Mm-hmm. And I know Jeff talked about this last week. I actually have the exact same problem. My buttons fly off my MA all the time.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And I think that the Camsys buttons, the actual flash buttons, were built in a similar fashion to the MA1 buttons. Mm-hmm. And so I do miss that. That's probably that. And then also having, I had the Camsys 300, which is 84 playbacks. And then I also had two extra wings, which is another 24 faders and 24 executors. So add that all up, 48 and 84, 100 and whatever, blah, blah, blah.
It's a lot.
I miss all of that physical playback. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that I miss about the Camsys now that the bitmapper has been incorporated into the MA. Before, a month ago, I missed that.
That's interesting. That's the only thing that you miss. I think that says a lot about MA2.
Absolutely. Well, okay, there's one. This is really like one real just like prissy little thing that I miss. And it baffles me that MA doesn't incorporate this into their system. If you select a group, any group, right, and you highlight a row of presets and push copy and then hit a playback, it copies that row of presets and creates a cue stack for you. So now why the MA, there's somebody told me the reasoning why, I can't recall what it was, but for whatever reason the MA will not and cannot do that. And so it made festival situations, on the fly situations, much easier, because you could create I could create a pun page for a festival in 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had, you know, if I cloned and transformed properly.
Yeah, so I guess you could probably build your own macros enough to get close to that, but
yeah, but it's just not the same. You know. It's just like, okay, well, what kind of fixtures do I have here? Okay, I've got three different types of fixtures. I want to make a color stack for each type. Shift, copy, boom, done. Shift, copy, yeah. boom, you know. And like, and you could do that with every preset type possible. You could just, if you double tapped your select button, which is like an old hog thing, you could pull up the edit window, throw a fade time in, a delay, whatever. Like, you could just, it was a little bit more manageable in a simplistic way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the macro system isn't very good, and honestly, I don't think I ever used a single macro on Camsys,
mm-hmm.
other than the reset macro that I think comes pre-installed on the desk.
Yeah.
So the MA is an amazing console. I wish I would have transitioned sooner, but I'm also the type of person that I just have to get there in my own time. My amazing programmer, Gabe Fabroni, I probably said his last name wrong because I always do. him and I have this whole running dialogue of he'll show me something amazing, I'll tell him it's stupid, and then a month later I'll ask for it.
Yeah.
And this has been going on now for over 2 years, and I think he's finally starting to come to terms with it, and he just doesn't bother anymore. He'll show me something, and then he'll wait. He'll wait for me to ask for it, and then he'll get it done, and it's amazing. Yeah. And I should just listen to him in the first place, but I never will.
It's interesting, because I remember hearing when you switched, and I remember thinking, well, there's the one guy we needed, because I feel like at least our little like jam EDM scene, you know?
Well, you know, and you're absolutely right about that, and something that I never understood why, but I always felt like the outsider, and I was like, oh, well, yeah, I'm on Camsys, blah, blah, blah. But until I switched to MA, and I realized, like, now we can all talk about the exact same thing. We don't have to just talk about the lights that we like. Now we can really talk about lighting. And it took me switching to really understand that. You know, it's like, you know, if you talk to a mechanic about what type of car he likes, he's going to get bored of you real quick. But if you could talk to him about the carburetor and the fuel lines and whatever, I don't know shit about cars, but I'm just using that as an analogy. You know, when you can really get into the nuts and bolts of it all, then you can have a real genuine conversation about the trade.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I made that switch to MA, all of a sudden I realized that my relationship with all of my fellow lighting designers got so much stronger.
All right, let's talk about your actual workstation. Because I think it's probably maybe the most impressive workstation of any of the guys in our little world, at least. Walk us through it. How many laptops are there? What do they all do? How many systems are there? And do they all talk to the MA?
Absolutely, they all talk to the MA.
Of course they do.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll start with the desk itself.
MA full. MA2 full.
MA2 full size. I have some auxiliary MIDI controllers implemented into the desk as well. I have a launch pad, and then I also have one of those little arcade button controller things.
MIDI fighter?
Yes, yeah. MIDI fighter, yes. So I have that going, and that all runs through a Surface Pro that translates all the MIDI dialogue from the controllers to the desk.
So you don't have any MA playback wings?
No, yeah. No. We tossed around the idea of getting one at some point. It just didn't seem necessary once I grew accustomed to using touchscreens.
Sure.
For me, and I think a lot of it has to do with the way that I run a show, I afford myself a little time by doing so much move in black. You know, so like I'm not reliant on pushing a touchscreen right at that exact moment. So much of the timing is literally off of 8 faders or 10 faders, depending on how it's set up. So all of the timing really comes into play on just the physical playback at the bottom of the desk. And, you know, so if I'm like, I have fat fingers, so that has a lot to do with it. So I hit the wrong button all the time. So I just kind of stumble around, you know, and then when the time is right, I just release those buttons, and that's when all the magic happens. So that's where the timing comes from, and it allows me to, you know, to be flexible and not be overly concerned with putting all of my playback on touchscreens. It also doesn't help that I'm running lighting, lasers, and video all at the same time. So so there's one. We're using two different types of lasers. We have Phenoms, which are moving head laser projectors, and those are controlled via Pangolin Beyond, which is networked to the desk, and that's basically your like the industry standard laser controlled system. And then there's six Phenoms, and then we also have, depending on the day, anywhere from 12 to 16, I think, Lixels, which is this amazing new product that's been out for a little over a year now. It's basically, think of a Sunstrip, KR10, whatever they're called these days, a 10-cell batten with 10 individual color mixing laser beams in them. In the beginning, it was literally just creating a cage around Derek. Just a few of them, just shoot them straight up into the ceiling and do some cool effects and call it a day. Over the last year, it's evolved into incorporating mirrors, and the arrays have gotten bigger, and so we shoot them all over the place, and it's, you know, and it's all pixel mapped, and it's some of the most fun stuff to play with, and it's almost because of how simple it is.
Yeah.
It's literally just a laser beam. You can tell it to be red, you can tell it to be green, you can tell it to be purple, and so on and so forth. And that's it. You know, and it really just the challenge is in how you set them up. You know, you could just turn them on, and if they're set up properly, the wow factor goes through the roof. You know, throw in the effects, and then, you know, that's when the real magic happens. But so
like on the Red Rocks rig, did you have two terminating against each other?
Yes.
On the downstage
edge? So the cage transformed from going north and south to east and west. And so we terminate them on each other so that, you know, that way you don't get any, you know, blow off on the outside, especially like if you're in an arena, you can't be shooting them into the crowd. So there's anywhere from four to eight that go on the downstage and literally create a giant grid across the front of the band. And then the orientation of the other Lixels has changed and evolved a couple of different times, but originally the idea was there was a second grid behind the band. And then on the first night, it was just the grid. And then on the second night, we would open up a mirror array and blast them all over the place. And we've changed that a couple of times. And now it's evolved to the point where we have these new mirror attachments that literally go right on the Lixel and give us even more control and also more brightness. Because the one thing I never really thought about was that when anything that travels over space loses power the further it travels. So when you have a laser flown 20, 30 feet up in the air, and then it's hitting a mirror, it's going to lose X amount of intensity. These new mirror attachments, the laser travels 3 inches and then hits the mirror. So the end result is a much more powerful and a much more controlled effect. You know, we get better symmetry out of it. In the beginning, it was such a nightmare. I literally told the guys to just splay them everywhere. I wanted it to be completely haphazard because I didn't want these guys to spend 3 hours focusing mirrors. You know, and so it was just it was asymmetrical, just mayhem all over the place. And now we're able to get really nice, like, splayed out looks. The beams pop much more. It's gotten to be way more effective.
So we've got the MA2 full size and then one laptop with Beyond.
Yep.
And
the Lixels are just straight DMX controlled.
Okay.
So they run just like a normal lighting fixture.
Okay.
You know, you just DMX in, address it.
Yeah, because there's no pattern.
Yeah, I just patch them as generic LEDs.
Okay.
And word of the wise to everyone out there, you can either take this advice or not. It's totally up to you. I hate multi-instance fixtures. Don't use multi-instance fixtures.
I have to agree. They're so annoying.
It's constrictive. It creates issues. So even with the BIs, I split it into two completely different layers. I patch the standard 21-channel BI profile, And then I have a separate layer, and it's just generic RGBW.
And they each have their own number.
They each have their own number.
The dot number is driving nuts, man.
And so I do that with the BIs. I do that with the Lixels. Any LED. And it makes it easier when you're cloning to another fixture, too.
Absolutely.
Because it's like, okay, well, if I have, you know, if I want to use, let's say I go to a festival, right, that has, I don't know, just auras, right? I can clone the standard profile of the BI to the aura, and it's seamless. Right, then if they have a bunch of LED battens or some stupid, you know, array of LED lights, I could take these specific BI cells and clone them over, and it's just the whole process is just so much easier, so much cleaner, so much more effective. Mm. So stay away from multi-instance.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got MA Beyond, and then your video.
Yes, and then in video world is. It's madness.
It's definitely madness.
It's we have some custom built Touch Designer servers that, first off, it was never supposed to be two separate servers. It was always supposed to be one. My approach to how the video should run, I think, was a little too lofty in the beginning, and the concern was that I would crash the system every night. So instead of sacrificing ideas, I sacrificed a backup and created two completely different systems. One that drives our full screen wall and has all of the photoreal urban content, as well as all of the camera feeds, all the live camera feeds. And the end result of that server ports into the other server.
Oh, so it's like own layer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so server B would be the full screen, just the big wall, the big upstage wall. And then server B feeds into server A, which takes the end result, feeds that to the big wall, but then also takes all of the headers and feeds ambient content around on those headers. It also controls the traceline generators that we have. It also allows me to panel map the entire video array. And then once again, just generic RGBs, maybe Ws. I don't know. I can't remember. And so literally every panel in the video rig is mapped like a lighting fixture.
So is that for like a color shift? Like you can take the content of magenta?
I can do a slew of things. Dimmer chases built in to the video that coincide with the lighting.
So each panel gets treated like its own fixture.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so the video runs regardless. And then I'm basically just affecting all the alphas. So I can take the intensity out. I can add color in over the top of it. There's some effects and things that I haven't really implemented yet. So basically, instead of maxing out one system and then just being like, well, we'll have a backup. We'll just jump to the backup. I said, what if we cut the load in half and use two servers simultaneously? The chances of crashing are much slimmer, but if one does, I still have something.
Yeah,
I don't have the full video show, but I have something. So I took a chance on that, and knock on wood, this IKEA wood, it hasn't crashed once. So that's, you know, it's been amazing. And then there's a third server, which is just good old fashioned our Chaos Media Master, which we spoke about earlier, which runs all of the low-res video,
Oh, okay. All
the slices, and then all of the spotlights. And then...
And soon to be the BIs?
Well, so no. Yes and no. Basically, what I did was I took that content and then squished it way down, compressed it way down, and then put it on the console.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it's actually ported over.
Yeah, it's ported over to the desk. So I think I'm limited to, what, 100 megabytes? Of content on the desk itself. Mm-hmm. So basically when the desk tells me I can't load any more clips, I won't load any more clips. But I think what I'm going to wind up doing is we have a whole new system as far as clip playback goes that's going to involve thumbnail retrieval in the layout view via some macros and stuff. And the bitmaps will be built into those clips so they can run in the background, and then I can engage the bitmaps when I want to and jump in and out of pixel mode.
Great.
Because another trick that I do that I don't know many other people do with the BIs is I actually everyone seems to change their default to on the BIs to the pixel mode, the 40.2 on the dimmer control channel. I keep mine at zero, and I will queue up. It's the same concept as everything else, moving black, right? So I queue up my chasers. I will, moving forward, queue up the bitmaps, everything in the background, and I have a layout view that I can see the live playback of the pixels themselves. For the BIs, and I just run the light as a standard wash. When I have everything set up exactly how I like it, I pop in that pixel mode, and then it's a whole new thing. And so I like when it's just a standard wash, it's just a standard wash. Mm. I'm using just your standard RGB to the 21 channel portion of the light, and everything else that I do runs in the background, and it never sees the light of day until I push that button.
Nice.
And it's just a simple toggle. And I just, because you can't put time on it because it's some weird goofy thing. So there's no fading from pixel mode in and out of pixel mode.
Yeah.
You just got to snap in, snap out of it.
Sure.
So that's what that's how I approach that. But it allows me to get things just right.
I wonder if you could write a macro that would take the wash look and build the scene, and then switch to pixel mode and fade from the wash look to your...
If you want to write me that macro...
we'll see.
By all means. Gabe, get to work, buddy.
Yeah. Gabe, this is an all call. Well, we're kind of getting there, but let's talk about your layout. I guess specifically on the punt side, but it sounds like nowadays you're all punt.
It's all punt.
Yeah, that's great.
Yep.
How's it laid out? Let's say you're a Laser Shark fan at home, you've got MA on PC, and you want to lay out your X keys and your faders and your touchscreens like you're using at Showtime.
All right, well, let's start with I want to start with the screens, because I think the screens are the most important for my show, because literally the faders are all just, over half of them are just intensity. Screen one on your left, even though in MA world that's
screen
five or whatever it is, yeah, right, four.
Four. Yeah. Four, excuse me.
One would be the little one that nobody likes.
Yeah.
And then it goes backwards. But anyway, so screen one, starting on the left, because we are in America, is just all of my simple preset playback for each fixture type. So it's color and position for the spots, the beams, and the washes, whatever the kit, whatever.
And they're all separated? You don't have this position for the whole rig?
I do. That's where. So I call those system playbacks, and that actually goes down on the faders or underneath the faders. So everything on the screens is fixture specific or type specific, whatever the case may be. So screen one is literally just color and position for each fixture type. That's it. Done. I have some macros that change the times for those playbacks, but that's it. Screen two is...
Or screen three. The middle screen.
Yes, middle screen is, for the most part, the bread and butter of the show. That is where our color picker lives, which is this amazing system of macros that allows me... Basically, I can call up any color and rewrite three presets... And every playback that references those three lines automatically update to call up whatever color I have chosen.
If I could take a stab at this, I think a good way to explain it would be there's three rainbows right there.
Yeah.
And you pick a color in each rainbow, and then everything else, if you wanted, in your show file, behaves to those three colors.
Exactly, yeah. So there's an A row, a B row, and a C row. So let's say, for instance... I'm running a two-color effect, and I'm calling up the A row for the low. I'm calling up the B row for the high, and I could just pop around and change that. So I have one effect, but it could be any two colors I want.
And for the curious MA2 programmers, that's a macro that's nested in a layout view and then colored to the right color?
Exactly.
Great.
Yep. And that's some of Gabe's mastery. I know it's kind of the hot thing, and people have been doing it for a while. I don't know enough about it to really get into the geekdom of it, but I can just tell you that we do it a little differently, and it's become so effective that it everything in the show references it somehow, some way, whether it be the lasers, the BIs, the video, everything has a relationship to that part of the show file. But it all came from wanting to do wipes, left to rights, in to outs, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, well, if I want to do a wipe to red or a, you know, or a wipe to blue or a two color wipe or a three color wipe, like, am I going to sit there and write?
Yeah, it's a lot of playbacks.
All of these, but then also want to change the times and all of this and yada, yada, yada. And so we literally, I have 15 playbacks now. It's a left to right AB, a left to right ABC, a split color, and then different orientations. And then we can change the times two different ways. We can either change the follow time, or I have a rate master that also changes the actual structure of the zero through blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So I can play around with those, and then I have 15 playbacks that can now be anything
you want.
Anything, yeah. I want.
And those are all down on the buttons.
Those are next to the color picker.
Oh, okay, okay. Yep. So this is still in that middle screen.
Yeah, still in the middle screen. And then above that, there is... I don't have my show view up right now. I'm trying to cheat. what's above that? There's some gobo stuff. There is... Oh, all my dimmer effects. Duh. Yeah, all of my dimmer effects, which control... every light, every panel in the video rig, and soon to be every laser, okay. Which is going to be very exciting.
And for those who are curious, are those temps or toggles or goes? What's the method of play?
For the dimmer effects?
Yeah.
They are all just goes.
Yeah.
Just goes with a Speedmaster. Mm-hmm. And then basically, because I don't use inhibitive masters, because you can't swap an inhibitive master.
Yeah, same reason I don't use them.
Yeah. Since I don't use those... I can just run those, and if all the lights are on, then it just runs in the background, and no harm, no foul.
Yeah.
I also have some macros where I can, like, stomp stuff out if I need to or whatever.
Go ahead.
And then I think next to that, it's actually funny, because the rest of that screen is changing at the moment, because we had some secondary gobo playback and stuff. Oh, I also have a touchscreen with all those sorts of other playback.
Is it an MA, like, touchscreen?
No, it's a... It's some giant expensive one that.
But I mean, it's plugged into the MA.
Yeah, it's plugged into the MA. Yeah.
So that's screen five.
Then. Yeah, that would be screen five. Yeah. So we'll get to that. So that the other corner of screen of the middle screen is going to change to be determined, and then
check back next time
on the right screen is basically the same idea, just with video. So it's my page control and my clip control, and I'm just calling up different pages, different clips. Which is that part of, and also for the lasers as well. And basically the way that I write my presets, which allows me huge functionality boost, is my page and my clips are written as separate presets. So I only write 20 clips, 20 clip presets, and then I have my 5 page presets. Mm-hmm. And so I can jump around page, and then I can, so it's the same, you know, 20 playbacks for the clips, and I just have to cycle through the 5 pages.
Sure.
So I do that for everything. So I do that for all media servers and for the lasers. But we're actually evolving that system into the thumbnail retrieval. Inside of a layout view, which will actually make my front of house less impressive.
You're going to lose a computer?
Well, I won't need to see them anymore.
Yeah.
It'll all be on the console. Yeah, yeah. But I don't know. Maybe we'll keep them up there just so I can keep looking cool, I guess.
To be honest, I got worried. I was like, dude, there's so many systems up here that one of them, I just get worried as an IT guy, you know, one of them is going to crash, you know?
Well, that's the beauty of having all of that stuff. Yeah. If one does crash, who gives a fuck? I've got 8 other things that are
going
on.
And you have a backup MA too, right?
Don't get me started. We have a light.
Oh, okay.
We have a light as a backup, so...
Yeah.
But, you know, Gabe does a really amazing job of keeping that show file clean and organized and all of that stuff. And we haven't had any issues. I think a lot when people start running into software issues like that, it generally has to do with poor organizational skills.
Yeah.
You know, not deleting unused sequences, you know, stuff like that. Or if your show file is just overly complicated,
we had a problem at a festival this summer where there were like 300 user profiles and just from like people loading their file without like, you know, And we had to just go in and clear them all out in order for show files to even load.
Wipe that whole fucking desk.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But one of the cool things, too, is we try really, 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 really hard to use my own desk when we're at a festival situation.
Oh, okay. Even if there is an MA2.
Even if there's one there.
Yeah.
Obviously, if it doesn't make financial sense, then I will use... But if we're sending a lighting package, we're probably sending my console.
Yeah.
You know?
So Pretty Lights doesn't own a console?
Nope.
That's probably wise.
You know, with the way the technology moves, it just doesn't make sense because we don't play enough shows, one. And two, if we owned it, we're not going to rent it out to anybody else to make the money back. Yeah, so it's like,
in a warehouse most
I've got 8 million monitors here in a command wing, and I get by when I need to. And then in the times when I really need a console for programming, we just rent one. And, you know, if we were on the road 180 days out of the year, then, yeah, maybe it would make sense to buy one. But when you're only on the road 3 months, like, it's just, there's no point.
Okay, so what do you have going on screen one, the actual screen one down there?
Oh, that's just my, that's color playback for the BI rings. So basically, which I'm probably going to change sooner than later, into and incorporating that part into the color picker system, because basically what I've done is I have on my external touchscreen, I have 60 or so chasers that are all of my BI pixel effects. Some are 3-step chases, some are 60-step chases. It just
depends.
Last year I had about a month where I had a BI in my living room, and got real deep and real weird into experimenting with all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the screen one, you know, it's just color overrides for each ring. So the top row is the outer ring, mm-hmm. next row is inner, so on and so forth. And half of the chasers have color built into them, half of them don't, they're just intensity. And then some of them reference the color picker once again, but I can, so let's say I have a chaser that's all blue, right? I can dump out color or change the color of each dependent ring and then just get more out of that effect.
Mm-hmm.
I also have underneath it in those like X keys down there, I have an all stack for the BI pixels that starts at black.
Mm.
So that way, let's say I'm running a chaser, and I want to keep the chaser, but I don't want it on, and I don't want to go back to whatever else. I can just hit the black, mm-hmm. right? And then that allows me to once again reset. It's another way of moving in black, right?
Sure.
So I can hit that black, and then if I want to just quickly go to red, then I skip white on mm-hmm. the BI pixels. It's there if I need it, but it basically, I just start at red and then go through the cycle. But that black is huge in my show because I could just cut it out real quick. And then if I need to bring it, you know, each individual ring, or I can bring in the whole rig, either way. So there's a lot of functionality there. And then the rest of those keys down there are like color effects.
Do you have like any strobes down there?
I used to until I got the MIDI fighter.
Oh, nice.
So all of my strobes are on the MIDI fighter, and I have it Velcroed to that little dead section right above the power button. It fits perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, it was made to go there. Gabe tells me all the time that I'm an idiot for doing that because I keep, there's like that muscle memory thing where I always go to reach for the X keys to hit my strobes, and there's that like half second where I'm like, and then I go up and I hit it. I'm getting better with it. It's only been a couple. It's literally been 10 shows.
It takes
time. Yeah, it's one of those things that takes time. It's becoming a more natural feeling thing.
You should see when I have to go from my MIDI console, all MIDI console, to a real MA.
I can imagine the hell you must go through.
Just banging my head against it.
But at the same time, you're like, well, yay, I'm actually on the big boy desk.
I feel both ways because there's way less buttons. So.
Yeah. But so there's like some effects, and there's some other system thingies down there. I don't use that section nearly as much as most other LDs do.
Yeah, some guys live there.
Yeah, it's like an afterthought for me, honestly. Yeah. You know, it was a big deal when the strobes were there, you know, because it's like any time. I use, I forgot, we got these the Alation Q-Picks, the LED moles.
Mm-hmm.
They also strobe, and they make for a really cool strobe light. So we have some LED nitro strobe thingies. But a while back, I cut all the atomics out of the rig, and I loved being able to strobe in that tungsten.
Yeah.
It was really cool. And so I do a mix of both now. So we have the harsh, you know, dead white, and then we have the tungsten, and I bounce between the two, or I use them together.
Yeah, it's cool because you get, for those who aren't familiar with these fixtures, you get like a warm glow. It would, what we would normally call a mole.
Yeah.
But it is quick. Yeah. Enough to strobe.
Yeah, so it actually has a strobe channel built into it.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
So it's not just some like gimmicky effect trying to replicate a strobe. It actually, has that built in. Because when you have to use like the old pixel lines or whatever, and you try to make them strobe, but they don't actually strobe, it just looks so bad.
I can imagine if there was like a Pixar movie about lighting fixtures. Those are like old and grumpy, and they're like, quit trying to make me. I'm not going to strobe that fast. They should make that.
That sounds.
I would watch that movie. So the other thing I think they should make, you know, if you're listening, PlayStation, Xbox, is Light Hero, you know, where you can load up your favorite LD's light rig and. I mean, that's basically what we're all doing, you know.
As long as we all get licensing fees, yes, I'm into that.
But how cool would that be? You get to load up Pulse 94 and play through Shine On You Crazy Diamond, you know.
Oh, man. But then every jackass is going to be like, oh, I'm a light guy now.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, it's really not that much different from what we do anyway.
Yeah, they'll all steal our jobs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we might lose our jobs. But as long as those licensing checks come in, you can have my job.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's a pipe dream. Okay, well, how do you feel about the strobe round? You ready for it?
Always.
Okay, well, in case you're not aware, you can answer these as quickly or as long-windedly as you'd like. But here we go. Favorite color?
I want to say something funny, but I don't have anything funny to say. God damn it. Cyan.
Favorite gobo?
None.
If you had to choose one color of the rainbow to never use again, what would it be?
Orange.
Wow, that one hurts, man. I love orange. Favorite video content designer?
Myself.
Ooh. Favorite psychedelic breakfast song? Let's say both to listen to and to light.
Lit.
For both answers?
Yeah, so that song is in 13. I didn't know that it was in 13, but I used to keep time to it perfectly. And somebody came up to me one day and they're like, did you go to school for music? And I was like, no, why? They're like, how the fuck are you doing lights in 13? I'm like, I don't know, I'm just following the band. And that was actually, it's the song is Madness, and it's about getting fucked up and being crazy, and there's a lot of relation to that. But it's also the song that I did played lightboard guitar too.
It's also called Lit.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So, but it's yes. I never thought about that actually.
Yeah. Or, well, how about favorite Pretty Light song to light?
This is very common knowledge. Ask any Pretty Lights fan who knows who I am, and they know that my favorite song is Understand Me Now. I literally cry almost every time we play it, and it's amazing, and I love it so much. And I want to actually expand on that because there was once upon a time when I did try to Q-stack songs. And Understand Me Now, at that time, was a new song. And it was at the time when Derek released the 3 EPs. Don't ask me when that was, but it was sometime long ago. And Understand Me Now was on my list. And there's this string section thing at the end of the song that I struggled with forever. I literally probably spent 2 weeks trying to make this song look amazing and just failed miserably. And then one day I got it. And the gratification that I got from that moment, like, I'll never forget. And then shortly thereafter, I completely abandoned the cue stack. And I was like, I could do this better live. And I started doing it. And it was actually one of those times where I think I got... I found more confidence in myself as an operator when I realized that, like, I'm probably a better operator than I am a programmer or a designer. Like, I think a lot of my talent lies in just pushing buttons and how I push buttons and how I, you know, embrace the show, you know, within the show, kind of. And so that song has always just really meant a lot to me, not only as far as musically, it's a beautiful song, it's an amazing song, but it's just meant a lot to me as far as how I've progressed, you know, as a lighting designer.
Favorite Star Wars character?
Jar Jar Binks.
Oh man, I'm out. I'm leaving. Is that your real answer?
Yeah. And that one goes out to my dear friend Whit Hawkins.
I'm not gonna cut it.
You cut that out of the fucking podcast, I'm never talking to you again.
I promise I won't cut it. I may never talk to you again, but okay, if you had a time machine with a semi's worth of modern gear, what one concert would you go back in time and light?
Pompeii.
Oh, Pink Floyd, Live at Pompeii.
I mean, how many other people have played in Pompeii?
Well, I mean, there's no lighting in that concert either, so
exactly. I would bring it with my time machine.
That's amazing. Photographer who best captures your designs?
Taylor Wallace from Alive Coverage. That ginger fuck does a great job.
You're playing laser tag. Are you on the red team, the blue team, or the green team?
I'm the referee.
Nice answer. Amount of money you would pay to have freaking sharks with freaking laser beams attached to their heads?
$0, because every time I hear that, I cringe.
Oh, I'm sorry. Favorite color combination?
It changes on the day.
What about today?
Today, I'm feeling green and UV.
That's my favorite.
Yeah.
Everybody
knows
that.
It's my favorite most days, but then there's other days where that, like, red magenta UV kind of dealio really gets me going, too.
Yeah, for me, it has to be green, like, beams and UV wash. It doesn't work the same if you make the beams UV.
Oh, see, I actually disagree.
Well, see, teach their own.
Because I do a green wash with, like, the UV, like, pixel effects and stuff, and it's fucking sick. It's the same idea, you know?
Yeah,
where the base is green.
Sure. But it just reminds me of, like, being in college or in high school and having, like, a black light in your room throwing around glow sticks.
Absolutely.
Okay, if you had to build a light rig using only one fixture model, what would it be?
The spiky.
You're sick in bed and can't make the tour. Who would you pick to sub?
Well, first off, I've done lights unbelievably sick a couple of times, so I would never actually let anybody else run my show. I would have to be in the hospital or in my grave.
Yeah, you can't be at the gig, and you have to call someone to come. Because I'm the same way, I mean, you know.
Man, you asked Jeff that question, and first off, his response of you was fucking priceless.
Yeah, it's kind of cheating. I appreciate Jeff.
But it was amazing. I would actually, you know what? I'm going to give the same answer that Jeff did for two reasons.
No, you can't.
I'm going to say Saxton, because...
That's a great answer.
I'm going to say Saxton for two reasons. One, because he's unfucking believable at what he does. But two, to return the favor for allowing me to sub in for him.
Okay, well, with that in mind, let's sidebar. Because I wanted to talk about this. We didn't get to it earlier. How was that whole experience for you? For those not familiar, Greg had to sub for Saxton on some Soundtribe dates.
I mean, honestly...
For personal reasons.
It was such an honor, first and foremost, to be chosen to do that. Secondly, it was more fun than I thought it ever possibly could be. I learned more about that band on a musical level, but also just like how they approach their shows. It was really eye-opening, and they entrusted me to just get up there and do my thing. I mean, I literally flew to St. Louis the day of the show. I landed at like noon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It was at the pageant. The rig was practically already built by the time I got there. And Chris Rupel, Saxon's programmer, or I know Saxon's his own programmer, but either way. He looked at me and he asked me, he's like, what do you want to do? You want to run Sax's show file or you want to figure it out on your own with your show file? I was like, I'm 100% running my show file.
Yeah.
I would never in a million years, one, try to understand the madness that that guy's got going on his desk. Two, I would almost feel, you know, I would almost feel ashamed of myself for not at least, you know, going in there with my best foot forward. It was really special for me. It's something that I'll never forget. And, you know, I hope maybe one day we get to do it again. Hopefully the reasons are the right reasons or whatever the case may be. But yeah, it was so much fun and it was so enlightening. And their fans are amazing. They, you know, I was really, really worried about the fan reaction.
Oh, he's a big deal in their organization.
Yeah, he's a huge deal. And, you know, I know how fickle and opinionated all music fans are and can be. I'm one of them, you know? And so, you know, they're big shoes to fill. And I, you know, I have my way of doing things. And, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, how the response would be. But, you know, they let me know when I fucked up. And they also let me know when I was doing a good job. And they were very positive. And it was just really nice to, you know, to get to be a part of all that. So,
excluding Soundtribe here, just in case, if you could light any one artist currently touring besides Pretty Lights, who would it be?
Muse.
Favorite cover to light? I'm not sure if this applies to you guys.
Yeah,
as well.
Well, you know, we have our version of covers, sure. You know.
Or maybe if you could pick a cover to light, what would you pick?
Well, so, I mean, he does, like, classic rock, like, sample, like, cover-ish-y songs. You know, they're produced. The new band now is jamming on. So, they're... Go look this video up. It is from the second night of our Nashville show at the Municipal Auditorium. It is his. It's the Radiohead, Nine Inch Nails, Nirvana mashup, and it's like 10 minutes long or whatever. And probably the coolest thing we've ever done at a live show, musically, lighting wise. Like, it was just. There's a whole backstory about smoke and fog and this and that. And if you go watch the video, you'll see that I have a very snarky sense of humor.
All right, that's it for my strobe round. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the light side?
You better not fuck up tonight, because if you do, I'm going to notice.
Sidebar here, we're in Atlanta, and Dobopod is at Terminal West tonight, so the pressure is on.
Have a great show, bud. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, my pleasure, man. All right, so if you want to know more about Greg, check out his brand new website, thelasershark.com. That's laser with a Z.
You know it.
Anything they should know about the website?
Yeah, it's... Not your traditional, like, business-minded website. It's more blog-oriented. Just a way for me to kind of connect with our fan base, new fans, other LDs.
Did I read correctly that you have a rig rundown coming?
I do. It was supposed to come out a week or two ago.
It'll probably be out before this is out, is my guess.
Yeah, I was actually going to try to get it out by Friday, but it's probably not going to happen.
Well, how about if it comes out before this comes out, I'll put it in the notes.
Yeah.
So,
but you know, basically, the community that's developed around Pretty Lights has become, unbelievable, and it's, you know, it follows in the same vein of, you know, the Grateful Dead and Fish. It's, you know, a very tight knit community. They're very, very passionate about the music, but they're also, you know, they're creative people. I try to connect with them. I've connected with them in several different ways over the last few years. As far as like collaborating with them, I've had some of the producers give me music, and I've created video content to it. So yeah, so the website is just another extension of that idea of, you know, connecting with the community, the fan base. But also just kind of, you know, I've expanded my artistic endeavors well beyond just the live concert experience, you know, taking photography more seriously, and obviously the video editing and stuff like that. So, you know, it's just a way for me to, you know, just, you know, put stuff out there. You know, I'm not selling myself. I'm not trying to get any business, none of that shit. You know, yeah. It's strictly just, you know, comes from a very good place.
Well, that's about it for episode 2. I kind of went long here, but I couldn't help but dig up the recording from 12:31:07 of Greg sitting in on Lit. This recording is brought to you by NK Diva, who we're going to talk about right over top the audio here. Thanks for listening. See you next time. I want to talk a little bit about a good friend of both of ours, MK Devo, Dave Peck.
David Pecoraro, I love you, buddy. Call me. I reached out to you not too long ago, you son of a bitch.
Have you ever had sushi with Dave?
Yeah, of course I have.
Okay, just making sure. Yeah. Because it's become, especially in the past 12 months or so, he has just gone, he is the sushi guy.
Yeah, me and him got some platter one time. I mean, it was supposed to feed 6 people. I think me and him ate it, just the two of us.
For those of you who don't know about Dave, check out MK Devo on YouTube. He is...
Yeah, he's the king of tapers. Other than, like, that, who's that, Silverchair dude or what?
I like Dave's work more.
Yeah, but he actually goes in and gets in trouble for taping fish shows and other concerts and stuff.
I have a funny story about Dave I have to tell because we're talking about him. The first time I ever met him, I had no idea who he was. He came to tape the Dopapod show. And we're in the middle of setting up, and the band is sound checking. I think it's a Sikamikadiko, Red Hot Chili Peppers song. Yeah. And the guys couldn't remember the words. And this guy, tapers, like,
Good Time Boys.
Yeah, he was like, oh, I know it's this. He knew the words. And we were like, do you want to come up and sing it? Yeah. So he came up during the show and sang this song and crushed it because Dave used to be in a Chili Peppers cover band with Tim.
Yep. And Adrian.
And Adrian, yeah.
And Ronnie from The Breakfast, actually. It was a power trio breakfast plus Dave Peck on vocals.
Yeah. Well, and so then...
They used to play this pool hall in somewhere in Connecticut, and I swear to God, some of the most rowdiest nights of my life.
Yeah.
Amazing times.
Well, then, like, the next day or whatever, you know, Dave puts up the video and sends it to us, and it's MK Diva, and I'm, like, a huge fish guy, you know. And I was like, holy shit, that was MK Diva.
So you didn't realize it.
Yeah. So then I'm like, well, we had this, it's just a cool story.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, Dave's a great guy. And one of those people that does way more than he probably should for the world.
Way more.
Than for the world of music. I mean, if you've ever been to his house, and I haven't been to his house in 6-7 years probably, but this dude has everything archived.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in 20 years, people are going to be like, this guy knows more about the jam band world than probably anybody, and has seen more shows and has
documented
more shows. He's
Well, Dave, we love you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
While we're listening to the lovely sounds of the breakfast here, I wanted to share a little trick I came up with this year that saved me a lot of time. So when you're moving from room to room, often the pan and tilt positions for all your different moving head fixtures change. You know, you've got different trim heights. You've got a big wall on one side or the other. Front of house is in a weird position. The rig gets built kind of off. Who knows? There's a number of reasons why it isn't perfect. So one day a couple weeks ago, I got a really, really perfect focus. I made sure every fixture was in the right position, spaced the right way, and it was a nice big open room. So I copied all of my position presets to another spot further down in the pool. For those technical MA guys, that's copy preset 2.1 through 50 at preset 2.101. So from then on, I have a selection of my full rig with really, really good presets built at the bottom. And no matter what I do to the ones at the top, the bottom ones are always, I know that those are always a great focus that I can go back to. So then when I go into a new room and I want to get a good focus back and I have to rebuild all my positions, I just run another macro. And the command line for that is copy preset 2.101 through, in my case, 150 at preset 2.1 through 50. And then a dialog will pop up and you just say merge. And there you go. You're back to great positions. Now, you might be saying, well, why don't I just load an old file where the positions are great? But, I mean, you can really clearly see that any work that you did that day on the show file, either whether that's during the check earlier in the day or anything that you happen to write during the show, you would lose. So this way you maintain forward progress as a programmer and a designer, but also efficiency as far as your day-to-day tasks. The first day I actually pulled this off, updating my pan and tilts took 5 minutes instead of, you know, 45 minutes. All right, everybody, I'll let you get back to this wonderful breakfast jam from New Year's Eve 2007 at the Electric Company with Greg Ellis on the light guitar. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time.